supporting WHYY Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
To WHYY.
Welcome to You Bet Your Garden. I'm your host, Mike McGrath. Coming up later in the show, Fertilizer 101. We're going to tell you why fertilizers with equal numbers on the label are actually unbalanced, and we're going to go through which fertilizers provide which nutrients and what those nutrients do for your plants. Very important information for a gardener to know. We're also going to talk about the establishment of a meadow as well. So we better hop right to your fascinating phone calls at 1-888-346-9499. Sapna, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Hi, Mike. How are you?
I am doing very well today. Where are you, Sapna?
I am in Ariel, New Jersey. It's across the bridge from Philadelphia.
All right. What can we do for Sapna in New Jersey?
We haven't really been able to enjoy our backyard very much, even though we have a very nice patio, because we have both mosquitoes in the evening, and we also now have wasps as well. The wasp issue is kind of a twofold one, because they've built kind of honeycomb-type nests in the umbrella in our patio furniture.
Oh, they love that. Yes, they love the folds of umbrellas.
Anytime we try and sit outside, they're buzzing around us very menacingly.
Now, the umbrella up or down?
It is down.
It is down. So they're inside the umbrella and are tremendously protected. But when you come out, they'll crawl down to the bottom and come out and say hello, see what you're doing.
Correct.
Right.
Yes. In the front yard, actually in our lawn, we have hornets or wasps or something that they built a nest in the ground, and we've had problems with them both this summer and last summer.
You have yellow jackets in the lawn, and I'm going to presume there's a 90% chance you have paper wasps.
Okay.
The wasps and hornets are very closely related. The yellow jackets in the ground are a hornet form of wasp. The paper wasps are true wasps in terms of what they mean to you. There's very little difference. They're both very aggressive, both painful stingers. The big danger is that yellow jacket nest is building in size every day. And by the time we get to the point in like late August where they go into their feeding frenzy, there are typically thousands of yellow jackets underneath. And so when they begin an attack and they pile on, it becomes really dangerous. All of the information you're going to need is at our website. I was going to send you to our website, You Bet Your Garden. Go to the Garden Answers A to Z for mosquito control, because I want you to spray your backyard with garlic oil to chase the mosquitoes out of there. That's a very safe and sane way to do that. And there's also detailed instructions on two different ways to get rid of that nest safely. Everything involves working at night, because when it gets cool out at night, the guards retreat down into the nest, and you have a few minutes to do whatever it is you need to do. Never try to solve a yellow jacket nest problem in the day when they're up and flying, because you'll just, people die from yellow jacket stings. They get stung by so many. So what I did that I found worked the best with my first nest is you get a whole bunch of ice, whether you have to buy it or steal it from a motel, put it in a wheelbarrow. Late at night, like 10, 11 o'clock at night, you just want to go out and you want to dump the ice over top of that hole. That's going to chill them out and give you a little bit of time. Then I want you to get a tarp, whatever size tarp you need, something heavy. It can be clear, it can be black, and use it to cover the hole and then make a ring of bricks around the outside to hold it down. They don't have any other way out, and they will smother very quickly in the heat of the day. My money would say to simply leave the tarp on until we get to around the middle of August, take it off, and then that's the perfect time for somebody in New Jersey to spread a little compost and reseed that area. The lawn will fill in brilliantly, and you don't have to worry about the old hole. Now, the fact that the umbrella is down is kind of big trouble for you. Oof, I'd send somebody I didn't like to open up the umbrella. And then you can spray them with insecticidal oil, an oil spray that kills insects. And to tell you the truth, PAM, a can of PAM cooking spray, works brilliantly on wasps. So if you want to team up, again, at night when they're going to move very slowly, have the brave person slowly raise that umbrella and then just spray the wasps as they come out. There aren't that many of them in there. And you coat them with the oil. They can't fly. They drop to the ground. You can step on them. And then when you get the umbrella open, spray the nests so that nothing comes out of them.
Right.
So
the only thing is, I mean, we would like to sit outside, and also we have a baby, so we'd like to sit with her outside, and we just don't want to.
And see, what you've used to make the baby safe is ice, a tarp, bricks, and PAM.
Okay. Thank you very much, Mike.
Good luck.
And enjoy your show, too.
Thank you.
All right, bye.
1-888-346-9499. Karen, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Thank you.
Thank you, Karen. How are you?
I'm pretty good. How are you doing today?
I am well, thank you. And where is Karen pretty good?
I am in Dayton, Ohio.
All right. Very good. What can we do for Karen in Dayton?
Well, in the spring of 2010, the hostas that were along the foundation planting on the west side of my home started to come up just fine. And then after a couple weeks, I noticed they weren't there anymore. And I went out and looked. And starting from south to north, they just seemed to be gone. So I took the plants that were still remaining to my local master gardeners, and they thought it was possibly a fungal blight that had moved up from the south that we aren't real familiar with around here. And the information they have says the only way to help get rid of it, if I want to put anything that's susceptible in, is to dig down 6 to 8 inches and replace all the soil. And if I do have to do that, if there's anything I can treat the soil with.
First of all, I'm incredibly dubious.
Okay.
All right, hostas. Now, you realize you did achieve a high level of garden talent by killing hostas.
I know. It's a rare talent. But
it really is. They're like running bamboo. They're my biggest weed problem.
Mm-hmm.
Now, were they planted in sun or shade?
They were in morning shade, noon and on sun on the west side of the house. And they did great for 5 or 6 years.
Okay, so they did do all right for the first. That they didn't look blasted with all that afternoon sun.
No.
You know, because hostas need literally no sun.
Right.
Did you feed them with anything?
When I first put them in, I fed them with some organic stuff I got when I purchased them, and then I just kind of let them go.
Okay. Were they mulched?
They were mulched with the local wood mulch.
Yeah. What a shock.
Yeah.
Okay. So do we have any idea what's going on yet, Karen?
I'm thinking something was in the mulch.
I'm thinking the mulch itself is a terrible idea.
Okay.
Wood mulch is a classic case of everybody does it and everybody's wrong. But if you go back 20 years, you never saw this horrible trend of so-called decorative mulching,
mm-hmm.
where people had these multicolored yards with foot-deep orange wood chips all over the place.
Mm-hmm.
And the difference is that landfills stop accepting wood waste. So the wood that used to get tipped into the landfill now goes to a chipping plant where we begin to lose track of what's bark, what's heartwood, what's chipped up pallets from China, what's construction debris, and then they spray paint it some god-awful color not seen in nature, and it does two things. First, because it is all carbon, it is all wood, it absorbs nitrogen from the surrounding area,
mm-hmm.
so it can actually steal all the food from the soil for your plants. If it is actually touching the plants, which again is something you'll never see in nature, you'll never see anything touching the trunk of a tree or the root area of a tree in nature, it will begin to rot that plant. So if you've got 2-3 inches of wood mulch surrounding your hostas, the crown of the hosta is always staying wet, and it rots away. So all you need to do is back off on the mulch.
All right.
You can use pine straw. You can use seed, hull, and nut mulches. You can mulch with rich black compost. You couldn't pay me to mulch my hostas. I've never seen the ground underneath my hostas. You know, they're such a riot of size. But especially with a plant that is going to live in shade, that's going to process water very slowly. It's very easy to overwater shade-loving plants because they use about a quarter of the water that a sun-loving plant does. So just think airflow.
Okay.
Less is more. No mulch should ever be applied deeper than 2 inches.
Right.
If you avoid wood mulches, you will lose no garden benefits, and you will prevent not only plant death, but these nuisance molds that stain people's homes and shoot these crazy puffballs and X-rated mushrooms coming up out of the soil. Wood mulch is totally unnatural, and no mulch is much better. And again, if you're talking about a shady area that's good for hostas, really consider a very little bit of mulch, and no mulch should ever touch a plant. Any mulching should always start at least 6 inches away from the stem, the crown, the trunk of the plant.
Wonderful. Thank you very much.
All right. My pleasure, Kara. Take care.
You too. Bye-bye.
Well, it's time for me to take a little break and alert all of our overplanted listeners that food banks around the country would love to receive donations of your extra homegrown goodies to help feed the hungry. You can find the food bank nearest you by visiting the Feeding America website that was formerly known as America's Second Harvest. Now it's Feeding America. But don't you go tallying your tomatoes for a good cause just yet, because we'll be right back with how to establish a meadow, how to feed your plants, and more of your fabulous phone calls. I'm Mike McGrath, and this is You Bet Your Garden.
Moss Acres supports You Bet Your Garden. Moss is a low-maintenance solution for shady spots where grass doesn't like to grow. Moss Acres offers information and a variety of mosses online at mossacres.com.
You're listening to You Bet Your Garden on WHYY.
Do you have love, time, or resources to help one child? Bethany Christian Services, a national nonprofit adoption agency, envisions a world where every child has a loving family. Since 1944, Bethany has provided adoption and foster care services, licensed in more than 30 states, including Pennsylvania, New Jersey, and Delaware. To learn ways to care for vulnerable children in our region and around the world, 800-215-0702 or bethany.org. Bethany Christian Services supports WHYY.
And the WHYY forecast, fair skies today, the high up to about 102 in Philadelphia. There is the chance for a thunderstorm later on. Tonight, again, the chance for thunderstorms, the low 79. And tomorrow, not quite as hot. Sunny skies for Sunday with a high of 93. Right now, temperatures drop back to 94.
WHYY-FM now reaches the Jersey Shore. Don't leave your favorite public media provider behind. Tune in to WHYY-FM at 90.3 in Cape May. WHYY-FM, member-supported public media for Pennsylvania, Delaware, and New Jersey.
Welcome back to You Bet Your Garden. Coming up later in the show, Fertilizer 101. You ever wonder what those numbers mean on the bottle or the bag? Any fertilizer package that has a label always has those three numbers on it? We'll tell you what those numbers mean. We'll tell you the ideal ratio of those nutrients for flowering plants. And we'll name some specific fertilizers that do specific things. We're also going to take more of your fabulous phone calls. But now it's time to welcome our guest, Catherine Zimmerman, who is the author of Urban and Suburban Meadows, Bringing Meadowscaping to Big and Small Spaces. Catherine, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Thank you for having me, Michael.
I will tell you that people wanting to rip out their lawns and replace it with a, quote, meadow is a constant topic in my emails and phone calls. And it generally doesn't take much back and forth for me to realize that's about as far as they've gotten.
Right.
You know, I don't want to have a lawn care service anymore. I don't want to cut it anymore. So I want to put in a meadow. And I think they're kind of hoping the meadow genie will show up, and the next morning they wake up, it'll be like a wildlife sanctuary out there. But it looks like it's the establishment, as with the establishment of any kind of gardening system, looks to be hard work.
Well, I don't think it's really hard work. I think this, with any garden, there's a process, and the process really starts with the soil and figuring out what your site is all about. Do you have a sunny site? Meadows are sun-loving plant communities, so you need a sunny site at least 5 to 6 hours. Then you have to determine, is it wet? Is it dry? Is it sort of medium soil? So a site analysis is really important. And once you've figured out, you know, maybe you've got a slope and at the bottom of a hill there's wet, so it's going to change. Your plants are going to change depending on exactly what's going on in that particular piece of the site. The next big step is clearing all the vegetation, and that I try to approach that organically. We can either smother the grass that's there, you can take it up with a sod cutter, you can use an organic spray, or you can just stop mowing. The most important thing is the first steps. If you don't do those first steps, then you're going to be fighting weeds, and you'll probably go back to turf.
Well, exactly the same as people who don't prepare a site for a lawn.
Right.
You know, they throw grass seed onto clay soil at the wrong time of year, pour some high explosives on it, and wonder why things don't look perfect anymore.
Right.
So one thing you didn't mention just then, one thing that concerned me, was your huge section on burning your meadow. And we're kind of just emotionally and environmentally against unnecessary burning here. I mean, you know, I have a lot of guys in the audience. Guys like to burn stuff. They don't need direction or instruction.
And they also like to mow.
I would hope that, well, they say they don't, but then they go out and buy $8,000 riding tractor toys with satellite radio and air-conditioned cabs and halogen headlights, you know, so.
Well, I spent quite a lot of time with my expert, Neil DeBull, who's the president of Prairie Nursery out in Wisconsin. The reason I put in the burning, first off, it's the natural way that meadows are regenerated, or prairies. Across the country, people burn. And so I felt that it would be better to include burning properly in the book rather than just ignore it.
I'm all for a year of smothering.
Well, the burning isn't to prepare the meadow. The burning is the maintenance after the meadow is established. I do say that you could use a propane torch to burn off vegetation to prepare the site, but the real burn that you're talking about is maintenance. It's not the
But
the
only
prep.
In some parts of the country.
Only where it's allowed, and it's allowed quite a few places. And, you know, I get mixed comments on that part of the book. Like, I'm so happy you put in the correct way to do this, to, oh my God,
we still
why
lost
do you
our
have
car
such big,
and
you
our
know,
eyebrows.
Right.
Yeah.
And it's, I'm sure, happened.
Now, what's the difference between a prairie and a meadow?
Meadows are really found to the east, where there are higher rainfall and forest canopy is more likely to happen. Meadows are really a succession plant community. They're the first plants that really come in when an area is disturbed. So in the east, where we have a lot of tree canopy, the canopy is opened up by fire, flood, agriculture primarily, then meadow plants, if nothing else is going on, will start to come in. But if you don't do anything, it'll go back to a forest eventually. Prairies are found to the west, the midsection of the continent, and they are really in dry, open areas. And as you go further west, they get shorter grass prairies. So that's primarily the plant communities are similar. They're, you know, cousins of plants here, but definitely in the midsection of the country, drier plant communities.
I thought one of the most helpful parts of your book, and one of the longest, one of the biggest sections, is the listing of plants color-coded to this huge number of different kind of microclimates. I really enjoyed, you know, squinting my eyes. I had to get a hand lens to try to read what number I am. But you give them a lot of information about the plants, which would seem to be crucial, because one of the things that's going to happen is you're going to have to fight off these invasives that have learned how to thrive in our land better than the native plants have.
One point I want to make about native plants that is not so terribly known, and I didn't know this until several years ago, but native plants do something more. They're host plants for our native insects, and I found out from reading and actually listening to a lecture by Doug Tallamy, who wrote Bringing Nature Home.
We know
that,
Doug.
I knew you did. So you know that, as he says, about 90% of our insects, our native insects, are specialists, which means they need certain plants, and they need the plants that they've evolved with. So the classic is the monarch butterfly will only lay its eggs on milkweed. And if we don't have the milkweed, then we don't have the monarch. So a lot of people don't realize that there's more going on with a plant than just the nectar, that the caterpillar really needs to be able to digest the plant. And it might as well be plastic if it's a plant from another country. And I it's funny because I've gone to some nurseries and I'll say, hey, where are your native plants? And they say, well, we sell ornamentals because they're pest resistant. Well, what that means is none of our insects can eat them. So that's true, but, you know, we do need to give our insects something to eat, because then it follows that the birds eat the insects, and you get a balance in your ecosystem that way, rather than like a monoculture lawn. That's not a balanced ecosystem.
Now, obviously, the way you establish the meadow, the things you populate the meadow with, is different in many more parts of the country than we traditionally recognize in agriculture and horticulture, which makes sense as you've gone up elevations and you got all this stuff happening. People are in little hollers, you know, everything becomes different. Are there areas that really lend themselves to this concept? I would think that the prairie states where this kind of plantings evolved more than anything, as opposed to where we are, which was always kind of hardwood forests.
Right. I think, again, you're talking about, if you're talking between prairies and meadows, then yes, some plants are going to do a lot better in the east where we have high rainfall. A plant is not going to be native to that area if it can't survive in that area. That's the whole purpose of that way you aren't watering the meadow, because you've put in a plant that knows how to live there. That's a key component, is picking the right plants. And I want to make a point that doing a native landscape like a meadow, as the title suggests, can be small. It can be an urban backyard. Can be a small meadow. We're really talking.
Don't
about
burn off what's there if you're in the city, kids.
We're really talking about bringing in a plant community that works for your area. And
there's no better example of it than one of the photos in your book, which is the High Line.
Yes.
In New York City, where they took the abandoned L tracks and turned it into a horticultural showplace.
And what was wonderful is they did a survey of all the plants. And when they had to rebuild the area, they brought back those same native plants. And those native plants, by the way, just moved into that area. People didn't plant them there. The native plants are here, and they, you know, want to be here, and I'm hoping that we can bring them back.
And if we can do it there, we can do it anywhere.
That's correct.
All right. Our guest has been Catherine Zimmerman. The book is Urban and Suburban Meadows, Bringing Meadowscaping to Big and Small Spaces. And, of course, it's available wherever books are sold. And Catherine, you have a meadow of your own?
I do. In fact, it's coming up very nicely. I was wandering around in it the other day admiring false blue indigo and penstemon, all kinds of columbine, all kinds of great spring plants. And pretty soon, meadows get really strong in July on. They're cooking still in October and November. So,
well, we'll let you get back to yours then.
Okay.
Thanks for coming in.
Thank you very much, Mike.
And now, back to your fascinating phone calls at 1-888-346-9499. Brian, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Hey, thanks, Mike.
Hey, thank you, Brian. Where are you?
I'm in Roxboro, Pennsylvania, right outside of Philly.
Very good, very good. A very hip area to be in. What can we do for Brian in Roxboro?
Well, I have two questions. I have two raised bed gardens, and where I'm doing corn and cucumbers and beans and couple different type of peppers and tomatoes. And the first question I had was about the corn, because I only have, and it's probably about chest high or more at this point,
okay,
but I only have about 14 actual plants.
Right.
And the first group is about 8 plants. And then in the other garden, there's about 6 or 7 more.
Okay, so you have 2 separate groups of very lonely stands of corn.
Correct. Yeah, exactly. And
are they the same variety?
It's a white sweet corn.
Okay.
I hear the same thing over and over again from people is, it's not a whole lot. How are you gonna cross pollinate it?
No, not cross.
Or just pollinate it.
Exactly.
Sorry.
Yes, when I started gardening, one of my biggest resources was the Johnny Selected Seed Catalog, which had better growing instructions than any gardening magazine did. And I think what they said, the minimum for like a little hobby gardener who wanted to grow their own corn in a traditional manner would be 36 plants.
Okay.
So you are under the minimum. So okay, you are going to hand pollinate your corn. You are going to go out and get intimate with the sexuality of your giant grass.
Okay.
So here's what's going to happen. It will come a time when the tops of the corn will stop growing and they will send up their giant tassels. Okay, you hope they're giant tassels. What are you feeding this corn?
I compost, so there's a lot of it is compost soil, and I've been doing probably every 3 to 4 weeks. I've been doing some pretty high nitrogen based organic fertilizer.
Okay, what have you been using?
Blood meal.
Oh, okay, excellent, good choice, good. So you should have a good looking plants when it tassels. You want to get up there early in the morning, and you just want to rub your hand up and down that tassel until you knock some of the pollen loose. You'll also notice, if you look really carefully on the sides of the plant, you'll see the beginnings of some whorls coming out. That's where the little ears of corn are going to form. And every grain of pollen that you get to land in one of those whorls becomes a kernel of corn in your final ears.
Okay.
So it's very straightforward. Corn is self-pollinating. You don't want to cross-pollinate corn. You don't want 2 different types of corn growing nearby. They could harm the sweetness of each other or one of the varieties. So if you're growing corn, you want to grow a lot of one variety, or be prepared to do exactly what you're going to do, which is to hand pollinate the crop. And so far, you're at the top of the game, because most people call me after the tassels are dead or something and
right,
want to know what they should do. And in nature, you know, you've got hundreds of plants jammed together. So every time a breeze blows by, the pollen grains fall into the correct places to make ears. You're going to do the best you can, and if you do it well, you should get some good-sized ears of corn. What you want to do is, I believe, when the silks start to turn brown, then when you think it's about time, checking by the number of days, I hope you save the seed packet, you know the number of days to maturity.
I do.
Once you get around there, don't be afraid to peel back a little bit of a husk, and with your fingernail or a stick pin, burst one of the kernels. If it is milky white, the corn should be sweet.
Okay, cool. My other question about that would be, I have different, I mean, there's some of the plants now, I'm starting to have the beginnings of the tassels coming out.
Good.
The top.
Good.
Basically, the other thing I heard was is that you could take a soft paintbrush or something like that.
That's more for true fruiting crops.
Okay.
That's where you'd be hand pollinating a cucumber or an eggplant or something, maybe even to create your own hybrid variety. The pollen with sweet corn is so big that when you see the grains start to get loose, that's where you just want to use your hand. But yes, to some degree, it wouldn't hold on to a paintbrush like little pollen would. But you do want to try to look for those emerging ears on the plant, and you do want to try to get all the pollen grains into there.
Okay.
You're really trying to put the hay down where the goats can get at it, because every grain of pollen that drops into one of these circular formations coming off the side of the stalk, every grain will become a kernel in your ear of corn if you get it in there correctly.
Okay.
All right, man?
Great. I appreciate it.
The more work you do, the more full your ears will be. Don't expect completely full ears like you would with a big stand of hundreds of plants, but you should be able to get some really sweet corn.
That's what I'm hoping.
All right. Don't let it go too long.
I won't.
Okay. Good luck, Bri.
Hey, thanks, Mike. I appreciate it.
Well, it's time for me to take a little break and remind everybody who has a cool season lawn that this is the most stressful time of year for your poor turf, and that it is absolutely natural and normal for that lawn to go a little brown and go dormant during a dry heat wave. It'll recover when the weather breaks, unless you panic and feed it chemical salts to try and force it to green up. Then it just might stay brown forever. But don't you go stopping that man with the four-step bag in his hand just yet, because we'll be right back with more of your fabulous phone calls and everything you need to know to have a well-fed garden. I'm well-fed Mike McGrath, and this is You Bet Your Garden.
You're listening to You Bet Your Garden on WHYY.
Mike McGrath, right back at you with local events. Get ready, New Jersey. I'll prepare you to finally fix that tattered turf of yours correctly and grow great garlic, pretty pansies, salad greens for fresh picking through the new year, and all the other plants of the second season when I give a free talk at the Hamilton Township Public Library in New Jersey at 7 p.m. this Tuesday, July 26th. The event is free, but reservations are required. And the wonderful anti-hunger group, Philabundance, is accepting donations of fresh garden produce to help feed the area's hungry. You can drop your extras off Saturdays from 10 a.m. to noon at any of 11 different area locations. We'll post all the details at the events section of our website, youbetyourgarden.org.
Coming up on today's Fresh Air Weekend, an in-studio performance and conversation with musicians Jillian Welch and Dave Rawlings. Their new album was 8 years in the making and is steeped in the traditions of bluegrass, folk, and country music. A review in Paste magazine calls the recording a rich, expansive roots album. Welch and Rawlings talk about writing songs and how they work out vocal harmonies on today's Fresh Air Weekend. Comes your way at 1 on WHYY.
Welcome back to You Bet Your Garden. I'm your host, Mike McGrath, and we're in the stretch now, cats and kittens. In just a little bit, we'll be getting to the question of the week, fertilizer 101. What do the numbers on those fertilizer labels really mean? What do the plants really want in terms of a ratio of nutrients? And what are the best sources of organic nutrients? We'll tell you all about it right after a couple more of your fascinating phone calls at 1-888-346-9499. Kay, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Hi, how are you?
Hi, Kay. I am doing just fine, thank you. How are you?
I'm fine.
And where is Kay fine?
Kay is fine down in Johnson City, Tennessee.
Good. What can we do for Kay in Johnson City?
I have a question about my compost pile. I've been making compost for about 3 years now. I use mulched maple leaves, grass clippings, horse manure, kitchen scraps, not any cooked food, though, garden scraps, and some coffee grounds. I've had good success with the first pile. I used 1/2-inch wire fencing, and I put it in a 6-foot circle with a 5 to 6 inch chimney in the middle of it. And
excellent.
I used wire fencing for the chimney, too. And the compost was a success, but the wire was kind of hard to deal with. It doesn't really stand up really well until you get it completely full of leaves. So last year, I changed to a square pallet design. I used pallets that were 4 feet by 3.5 feet, did them in a square, and I moved my compost piles to the north side of my garage. And they were open to the sky. There weren't any trees to block any rain or snow, and I left them there for about 5 months this winter. I didn't turn them or anything. This spring, when I went to deconstruct them and get the wonderful compost out of it, they were just as dry as toast. It was like there was nothing, you know, I didn't have any water on them at all. So I assume there's a rain shadow behind my garage.
Yeah.
So this spring, I went to a whole different thing. I moved the piles back near to where they had been with the wire pile, and I put them in a triangular design. So there's less area for the pile to come up. But I thought, well, that way, because the pallets have slats and they're open on the sides, that I still wouldn't have to turn them.
Okay.
So far, they seem to be doing okay. But the problem I'm having is I think there's a large cantaloupe growing from the top.
Ah!
Well, and I also just saw a tomato plant growing out the side between the slats. Is this normal?
Yeah, absolutely.
Oh,
yes.
Okay, well, that's good, because I know they're supposed to get to a certain temperature. Like about, what, 120?
Well, I think the first pile you described, the one where you made the big wire bin and you put the chimney in the side, is that a tip you picked up from our website or the show?
Actually, a friend of mine who is like one of my garden gurus suggested that.
So you had a big round pile, lots of airflow. You had that chimney in the center, a lot of rich ingredients. The only thing I worry about is grass clippings if the lawn has been treated.
I don't treat my yard.
Okay.
It grows really well without fertilizer.
Excellent.
And I have a mulching mower, and that's what I use to chop the leaves up, and I generally don't bag my grass clippings, but when I do, I put them on the pile.
So tomatoes, the seeds of tomatoes have a gelatinous coating. Seed savers learned this long ago. When you take seeds out of a pepper, for instance, the seeds are already dry or you know, ready to be dried. Inside of a tomato, you think about the seeds. The seeds have this, like, coating around them, like Slimer hit them from Ghostbusters. You actually have to ferment that coating off, and then you get the naked seed that can be saved for the following year. So what happens is, in a compost pile, the gelatinous coating gets fermented off, and then the tomato sprouts. Your original pile with the horse manure, the grass clippings, everything chopped up good with the chimney in the center, that probably did heat up enough to prevent any seeds from sprouting.
Okay.
But you get a tomato seed on the outside of a pile that, even if it heats up to 100, that seed is just going to have its coating burned off, then it's going to sprout. But go back to what you were doing originally. The larger the pile, the more chopped up the ingredients, the more central the airflow, and yes, the more nature can water it, the more compost you're going to make without any work from you.
Okay. All right. Well, thank you very much. I appreciate it.
All right. Good luck, Kay.
All right. Thank you.
1-888-346-9499. Rich, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Hey, Mike. How you doing?
I'm doing good, Rich. How are you?
Pretty good.
And where is Rich pretty good?
I'm in the heart of South Philadelphia.
All right, what can I do for Rich in South Philly?
After quite a long wait, I finally got a street tree put in front of my house.
Okay.
And it is a London plane, and they put it in April. And the problem is, I started to notice about a month ago, the new growth was coming out sort of yellow and curly, and now some of the smaller branches are sort of looking stunted, and there's this yellow, curly growth, and the leaves have some little holes in them and a little brown fuzz, and there's also some little stripes on the trunk that looks like you know what I see pictures of on the internet as something like canker stain or
something. Stop it. Everybody wants disease. I mean, gardening seems to inspire some sort of horticultural hypochondria.
Am I being a Google chondriac?
Yes. I mean, this thing just got put into the ground in an unnatural situation, probably may not have been planted correctly, probably hasn't been well cared for, so you're looking for vague tropical diseases online. Who planted it?
You know, the community group that puts in the trees under the direction of, I guess, the Horticultural Society.
Did you see them put it in the ground?
I was unfortunately away on vacation when they did it, but I've gone out with them before myself.
Okay,
so
good. So
I have
they,
an idea of how they do it.
Did they plant it high enough? Can you see the root flare? Does it look like a lollipop?
Yeah, I can see just the top of the root flare.
Perfect. And what did they do to water it during its time of establishment?
Well, normally they water it a lot right when they put it in, and then it's up to the homeowner. So I've been watering it plenty, like I guess probably 15 or 20 gallons a week.
But how?
Slowly from a bucket, like I just like slowly let it soak in.
Okay, and how often do you do that?
Every couple days, depending how hot it's been. That's, more if it's, you know.
Right. What's protecting it from dogs?
Well, I built a little wooden fence about a foot tall, so the dogs and stuff do not go in there.
Oh, okay.
I've been babying this tree like anything.
Well, a newly planted tree does require attention the first year. Is it mulched with anything?
I had put some, like, buckwheat hulls on top. The actual dirt there isn't that good, so
right.
I loosened it up and I mixed in some organic, you know, sort of, I guess, basic organic-type soil from the local garden shop.
You mix some compost into the top layer?
Not exactly. Some coffee grounds.
Why'd you do the coffee grounds?
Because I had them.
Oh, okay. That often does not have an equal sign between it, you know. Why'd you put vinegar in the gas tank? I had it. Okay.
Yeah, that's been a problem with the car, too.
Have you done any other freehand feeding?
No.
Just coffee grounds?
No, and not much of it anyway.
Right.
But I'm
confused. What did you mix into the top of the soil?
It's like organic, you know, non-fertilized. I don't think I have the bag anymore. But it's regular garden soil that you buy from a local plant store, but it's not the fertilized stuff.
I like the buckwheat hulls. Did you buy a bag of buckwheat hulls?
Well, my mom had some extra ones.
Okay.
Yeah.
They're an excellent mulch. No more coffee grounds.
Okay.
Keep up the watering, especially, you know, now that we're in the midst of summer and this is the real hardcore time for the tree. I would like you to get some compost. Put it on the surface of the soil. I love the buckwheat hulls, so feel free to scrape those off. Put like an inch of compost down and put them back on as a mulch. You have to realize in an urban environment like this, God knows what people are doing. You know, dog pee can still get through your fencing, although it's good that you've manufactured some distance there. Give it a gentle compost feeding. Keep up with the watering. And then just don't stare at it. Let it get established. Let it go through a winter. And let's see how it leafs out in the spring.
Okay, thanks a lot, and I'll stay away from the Google.
Yeah, good luck.
Thanks, Mike.
All right, as promised, it's time for the question of the week, a little something we're calling Fertilizer 101. We begin with Michael in North Carolina, who writes, "Twice this year, friends have come to me and said, my tomatoes are all vines and no fruit. I asked what they were fertilizing with, thinking they were applying too much nitrogen. And to my surprise, both replied 10-10-10. I said, that'll do it. What I don't know is why anybody would think 10-10-10 is fine for their garden, or how to help them fix the problem they've caused. Maybe by next year, this crappy fertilizer will be flushed out by rain and water. Well, I have mixed feelings about you, Michael. On one hand, you're my new favorite listener, because you know how bogus so-called balanced fertilizers like 10-10-10 are. On the other hand, if more people did know stuff like that, I'd have to go out and find a real job. Seriously, you're absolutely correct. 10% nitrogen is only appropriate for non-flowering plants like sweet corn and lawns. It's way too much nitrogen for plants that flower, like tomatoes, squash, beans, peppers, melons, eggplant, and, oh yeah, flowers. And bogus even number fertilizers like 10-10-10 and 20-20-20 are always composed of concentrated chemical salts. and the super fast growth those salts cause makes plants extremely attractive to pests and disease. And those salts, originally designed to be used as high explosives, ruin the soil and kill the soil life that keeps plants naturally healthy. And finally, despite their seeming arithmetic balance, fertilizers like 10-10-10 are absolutely unbalanced because no plant uses those three nutrients in equal amounts. All right, a little background. The three numbers, commonly referred to as NPK, that appear on the label of every packaged fertilizer, represent the three main plant nutrients, nitrogen, phosphorus, and potassium. The potassium is sometimes called potash. Studies have found that the ideal ratio of these nutrients for flowering plants is 3-1-2. So look for that ratio on the label of packaged fertilizers. Anything close to a 3-1-2, a 6-2-4, or a 9-3-6 should be ideal. But beware of higher numbers. They reveal that the product is almost certainly nasty chemical salts. My advice to folks like Michael's friends is to water on the heavy side to try and wash those salts out of the soil as quickly as possible. Feed with compost alone for the rest of the season, and then move to organic fertilizers and/or compost in the future, and sin no more. We move on to Nina in central New Jersey, who writes, "I've been growing heirloom tomatoes for a few years now with reasonable success, but I would like to know how to build on that success. I understand that some fertilizers promote root growth. Some promote leaves, and some encourage flowering. I have some fish emulsion and a seaweed solution. Which should I use, and when should I use it to maximize my tomato yields?" Ray from Front Royal, Virginia, has a similar question. He writes, "I'm curious about the difference between bone meal and blood meal. Would I use either one for new plantings?" Well, nitrogen, the first number of an NPK rating, grows big plants with lots of leaves. But too much nitrogen, especially combined with a lack of other nutrients, will actually inhibit flowering. The plants that thrive with lots of nitrogen are the non-flowering grasses and grains, like lawns and sweet corn. Now, blood meal is a high nitrogen fertilizer. It rates 12% nitrogen, a very high number for a natural product. Also high nitrogen are fish meal and fish emulsion, horse and poultry manures, and corn gluten meal. And that corn gluten also prevents seed germination, making it the only natural springtime weed and feed you can use on lawns. Now, phosphorus, the middle number on that label, is best known as the nutrient that produces more flowers and fruits, but it's also essential to strong root growth, especially early in the season. Bone meal is the organic source that becomes available the fastest, but many growers prefer rock phosphate or colloidal rock phosphate, which release the nutrient slowly and for a long time, like 3 to 5 years. But that slow release also means you should try and apply any rock phosphates the season before you want your blooms boosted. Now, potassium, the third number on the level, helps plants process all nutrients more efficiently, improves the quality of the fruits, and helps plants resist stress. The best single ingredient source of potassium is a substance called green sand. It's a mined mineral formed in prehistoric oceans, and it also contains lots of important trace elements and minerals. Green sand releases its nutrients the slowest of all, over the course of a decade. So like the rock phosphates, always try and spread green sand in the fall in preparation for the following season. But it's important to remember that all fertilizers, chemical or organic, rely on soil life to make their nutrients available to plants, and that high levels of organic matter in your soil are vital to the healthy growth of all plants. So all fertilization plans should begin with an inch of high-quality compost applied to the soil, preferably on top of that soil as opposed to being tilled into it. then as the season progresses, you can give your plants a little boost by adding more compost or using a well-balanced organic fertilizer. Remember, that ratio you want to aim for is 3-1-2. I like to use a liquid fish and seaweed mix for that mid-season boost, as these products provide a nice balance of basic nutrients and lots of essential trace elements from the seaweed component. Just water it into the soil around the root zone. If you prefer granular fertilizers, spread the material evenly over the soil, beginning about 6 inches away from the plant stem, and then cover it with some soil or compost to help it get to the plants faster. Well, that was some interesting information about the wide world of plant foods now, wasn't it? Luckily for you, this and every question of the week appears in print at the Gardens Alive website. To read it over in detail with links to lots more info and resources, just click the link at our website, youbetyourgarden.org. Yikes! My producer is threatening to feed me 10-10-10 if I don't get out of this studio. We must be out of time. But you can call us anytime at 1-888-346-9499 or send us your email, you're tired, you're poor, you're wretched refuse teeming towards our garden shore at garden@whyy.org. Please don't forget to tell us where you live. Please, please, please put the actual subject in the subject line. No more of this good morning and hello and how are you. I got to retrieve all that from my junk emails. And check first to see if the information you seek is already waiting for you at our website, youbetyourgarden.org, where you can click through to the question of the week. Find the solution to hundreds of garden problems. Hint, hint, just like the one you were going to email us about. Hint, hint. In our Garden Answers A to Z section. And or listen to this show, listen to old shows, and or download this week's podcast. Elizabeth Perez Luna is executive producer of audio content for WHYY. Ken Queter plays our theme song. Our engineer this week has been Al Banks. Our webmasters are Richard the Barbarian Banowitz and Sarah the She-Devil Kazar. Our well-fed intern is Jessica Mandick. Special thanks to our talented volunteer, Heather McLean. The perfectly balanced Alexis Landis produces You Bet Your Garden for WHYY-FM in Philadelphia. Nitrogen-rich Al Banks is our editor. I'm a perfect 10-10-10 Mike McGrath, but I will try and regain my balance in time to see you again next week. Is it safe to eat garden produce that's been bitten by a bug? I'm Mike McGrath, and on the next thrilling episode of You Bet Your Garden, we'll discuss how to best utilize less than perfect pickings, plus your fabulous phone calls.
Mike narrates the know-how necessary to a notable and natural garden on You Bet Your Garden, Saturday mornings at 11 here on WHYY.
The Wistar Institute is proud to